This week on the show, we visit Frankfurt Buchmesse to speak with one of the top literary editors in Germany. We discuss how Swiss media group Ringier is planning to expand its presence in Africa, and a little bit of fashion and some fauna too. Style and substance ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up, we attend the largest book fair in the world in Frankfurt and speak to the editor of a new biannual title about wildlife and lifestyle. But before all that, we head to Switzerland to speak with Robin Ling, the head of international marketplaces for Swiss media group Ringier. Robin spoke to Monocle's Ben Rylan about the increasing presence of Ringier in Africa and to explain the opportunities and challenges of doing business there.
Originally, we have been for 175 years a traditional printing and publishing company, and then about 10 years ago started transforming our business completely. Nowadays, we are doing 70% of our EBITDA in digital businesses, in marketplaces and digital publishing. So it's mainly content and marketplaces. In some countries, particularly in our home country, Switzerland, we are also strong in events, in ticketing and radio.
Now, for anyone who perhaps isn't familiar with the company in a practical sense, can you give us a little bit of an explanation of some of the key titles, the flagship titles that help to make Ringier what it is?
For sure, in Switzerland, there are titles like Blick, which is the equivalent to the German Bild. We do a Schweizer Illustrierte here, that are kind of the flagship print, original print titles, now well digitized. We also are strong in business publication, Bilanz, for example, here. Then we have a lot of flagship titles in Central Eastern Europe, from Newsweek, etc. In classifieds marketplaces, it's the Scout Group in Switzerland for cars and real estate that belongs to us. It's JobCloud, which includes the leading e-recruitment marketplace, jobs.ch, many similar businesses around the globe.
You mentioned earlier the transformation that Ringier has undergone into the digital space since that sector of the media has been on the rise. If we look at the media sector in a broader sense, looking across the globe, there seem to be a lot of examples of titles and publications that have struggled to make that transformation. What's it been like for Ringier?
Well, we also struggled, but I think we took a bold decision 10 years ago and then also executed it in a very bold way. We invested about 2 billion Swiss francs into this process in digitizing our core titles and then in building the digital expertise and business models, particularly in classified. A tough journey, definitely. Nowadays, we are very happy that obviously we have new cash cows, mainly coming from the marketplace businesses, and that our leading titles, the most important publishing titles, obviously are catching up on the digital revenue side. I think it's no secret. There is still no end game in sight how journalism, qualitative journalism in the future can generate bigger profits than now. And we are still obviously there looking to do the right things on a technology end, but also business model wise.
I expect that you would have been taking a close look at what some other companies have been doing and noticing some of the good things they've done and perhaps some of the pitfalls they've stumbled upon as well. Now that you've been walking through this whole digitalization process and business transformation over the past few years, can you suggest any good tips that other companies should be looking at and maybe some of the pitfalls that you perhaps see that are a little bit all too common?
Well, I think the most important thing is to move and to really transform. And if you have not started yet, then maybe it is too late. Once you have obviously started the process, it is about executing it as bold as possible, to try things, to stop things if they do not work, to do them even more if it works out well. Also, forming alliances, corporations is very important. For example, as we did it here in Switzerland with other companies like Swisscom and also Swiss Television, it's a game at the end of the day where it's also about building and transforming a new ecosystem for publishers. This is not something that you can necessarily do completely alone. Find partners and do this together in order to have their also stronger positions in the market.
Some people have suggested that in the age of online media, the concept of geographic publications has become less important. And we've seen that, I suppose, in the case of the New York Times is an obvious case where it has become much more of a global newspaper rather than simply a newspaper for New York. What are your thoughts on geographic-based publications on the internet? Do you think most online media companies should be looking beyond their traditional readership?
Well, everybody, of course, has to increase the audience and find additional audiences. But I think there are only very few international brands that can really go for a global audience. Some traditional ones that you mentioned, maybe some new ones from the English-speaking world, like also BuzzFeed or Business Insider. But I think for most of the publishing companies, it is still about serving a local audience. Obviously, language permits maybe to expand and also cross some borders. But at the end of the day, I think with a few exceptions, it remains quite a local business and you have to target and serve correctly your local audience.
Well, speaking of geographic targeting, Ringier has expanded into Africa. Can you tell me a little bit about the reasons behind that move?
I think the main reasons are two. First of all, doing business in young markets is a strong part of our DNA. We are doing so for more than three decades. We started in the very early 90s in Central Eastern Europe, built there a multi-hundred million company within 30 years, a big success story. We became the largest publisher in 5-6 of the big countries in Central Eastern Europe. Also 30 years ago, we started in Vietnam and China. Did a good job there. So obviously, looking at the next big thing 6-7 years ago, Africa came kind of naturally into the picture. At the same time, as I said, we transformed our business heavily and we're looking to where deploy this technological digital know-how and technology that we acquired and built over the last 10 years. And there also, obviously, we saw lots of opportunities on the African continent that is, obviously, as we all know, leapfrogging some of the processes to become digitized.
And you mentioned some of your key flagship titles from Europe, perhaps your traditional audiences that really underpin what Ringier is as a company. Does that differ when you look at the company's expansion over the past few years into Africa? Do you see other types of titles really taking off?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, there, our big flagship brand in publishing is Pulse, a brand that we just first started in Nigeria, then expanded into Ghana, and 2 years ago also into East Africa. Pulse is a brand very well known now on the continent. We are reaching more than 200 million Africans on a monthly basis, with obviously huge audiences on all social media channels, etc., etc. And it's a brand when you go to Lagos or to Accra nowadays, people starting from the migration officer at the airport to your taxi driver will know.
That was Robin Ling from Ringier there in conversation with Monocle's own Ben Rylan. They've been busy, our Monocle correspondents this week. Hester Underhill was at the Frankfurt Buchmesse, Book Fair, where, amongst others, she spoke with Andreas Plathaus, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung's literary editor, about the importance of the fair in the world of publishing and what the FAZ is doing to make sure new literary voices are being heard in Germany today. Andreas began by explaining what you need to have in your arsenal to be a great literary editor.
You need a lot of experience with literature. You've got to read a lot before becoming a literary editor. And that's something which is missing in the moment. Young people are not reading that much anymore. And even in the universities, not too much reading is asked for. And that's a pity, because if you don't know the classics, you can't really value what the modern authors are doing. You don't see the tradition they are coming from, and you are not seeing the changes they are putting ahead, and that's really bad. So I think everyone who wants to get in this job has to spend a lot of time reading before he's really earning money, but it will pay off.
Because I've actually just been doing some interviews with the editors of literary journals and the IndieCon, so the more emerging titles.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there's something that is on your radar, you know, for example, Edit, Sand. Maybe
yeah,
there
of
are some coming out of Frankfurt.
Of course they are, definitely. And of course I'm looking what is going on there. But I'm still trying to complete my literary education. It never stops, of course. You can never read all the classics.
Mm.
But the more I read them, the more I'm learning. And I'm learning more from these kind of books than from all the very recent things. I see. Of course, you've got to take a look at them. But if it's possible, I'd spend more time on rereading or reading things I've never managed to.
And so have you read many German authors, thanks to George's appearance as guest of honor this year at the fair?
I've not read too many Georgian titles, that's for sure, five or six this year. But that's not so bad. It's a small country and I've never read Georgian authors before, so it was a beautiful experience. And I just finished reading Romanian authors. They were guest of honors at the Leipzig Book Fair in spring. And so all these guest of honors are really very interesting because you get so much translated and you have a real wide selection. But normally, of course, my major interest is in German authors. I think it's the normal way for a paper who's appearing in German that most of our readers are interested in German literature. But when it comes to the classics, well, I've read most of the German ones. So now I'm trying to reading a little bit more of the Italian and French ones. And of course, there's so many English ones and American ones, I will never stop reading them too. In a way, it's a little bit different. When it comes to recent literature, it's more the German ones. When it comes to older literature, I'm going into different languages.
So personally at the FRZ, what do you do as a paper to support young voices?
We're printing them.
Okay, great.
We try to print, well, of course, short stories or things like that, as far as possible in newspaper, but every few months we do that. And we try to get in contact with young authors and try to make them work for our paper because it's so important that we have a generational change, even with our very, very long and very popular authors. You always have to look what is going on the younger artists and what they are doing, and you have to give them the possibility to make their voice hearable. Yeah. And the paper is a beautiful way to do that. Many people are reading it. Of course, not everyone is reading, let's say, a short story or so. But normally, I guess at about 10,000 or 15,000 people will read it, and you will never sell that many copies of the book. So that's a beautiful opportunity, and we're still paying for it.
And so, in terms of good independent publishing houses here at the fair, are there any that we should be keeping an eye on? Are there any kind of emerging young faces in the publishing world here?
Yeah, they sure are. They are not that young anymore, I've got to say, but one of the most fascinating ones, it's already 15 years in the business or so, but it's still one of the really cutting edge publishing houses in Germany's cookbooks. But I think they're publishing poetry, but it's beautiful experimental poetry. I love it very much. And they have a wide range of generations of authors. They are very, very young, very, very aspiring authors, and they have very established ones. We didn't find publishing houses anymore, but got the chance there, and they are doing beautiful work. And then there is a publishing house in Leipzig, Spector Books, who's at the edge of art books and literature and essays.
I interviewed them.
Oh, I see.
But I went to Leipzig a few months ago, and I did a piece on Leipzig and the kind of how its history is like a city for printing.
Definitely.
Is translated into the modern day.
Yeah. And Spector Books is a beautiful example for this because they are doing so beautiful.
They're really gorgeous.
They are very keen to publish beautiful books.
Yeah.
And that is one of the chances for the printed book, I guess. There's really a reason to buy books and not read e-books.
Yeah.
I'll never get an e-book of a Spector's title. Why should I? It's so beautiful to have it in your hands. It would never work on a tablet.
And so what are you most excited about seeing at the fair this year?
Oh, that's very difficult.
Is there any particular event?
Normally, the coincidental meetings are the most aspiring ones. The ones you never thought about before. Just some authors you are running into, just some publishers who are telling you something very interesting they have never told before. And of course, I love taking a closer look to the Georgian Pavilion, for example. And it was very interesting to hear the federal president yesterday. Frank-Walter Steinmeier, the German president, was here and had a discussion about freedom of speech just down there. And I love it when the high-profile politicians really pay a little bit of homage to the book business. So I was very happy to see him here.
And I was just wondering what your thoughts on the translation process is. Is it inevitable that there's going to be loss and clashes in this process?
Yeah, of course. It is inevitable. But it's the only chance, especially for smaller languages. How could someone learn Georgian? Of course, there will be some dozens of people in Germany who do, and beautiful, but that's, of course, not the thing that authors are trying to reach. It's great that you have some dozens of Germans who will read Georgian original titles, but if you want to reach a broader public, you simply have to have translations. And a lot of it is lost, but some is gained too, because translators into another language, they know, of course, their public, and so they know what kind of books are worth being translated. And, well, that avoids many disappointments.
Yeah.
So I think the job of a translator is one of the most important we have in the literary scene. And I'm really fascinated by the work they do, because without them, let's say 90% of all the literature in the world wouldn't be made for me. And that would be a shame.
A Magazine was conceived in Antwerp in 2001 by Walter van Beerendonk, the long-standing director of the Antwerp Fashion Academy. Each issue focused on, and was made in collaboration with, a different fashion designer, whether Hossein Chalayan or Victorin Rolf. However, five issues in, the publishing house behind the magazine closed. A new iteration, titled A Magazine Curated By, was launched in 2004 and continues, with the premise of asking a different designer to oversee each issue and conjure, well, whatever world they so desire. Monocle's Jamie Waters sat down with Paris-based editor-in-chief Dan Thorley and editor-at-large Blake Abbey to find out more about this esteemed and thoroughly distinctive fashion title.
Each time we ask one of them to curate the magazine, what we're doing is we're giving them a carte blanche, we're giving them free rein to open up their universe and their community and their ideas and everything that they would like to express that's not expressed with clothing, and put it on the printed page in a 200-page document that is treated like another fashion magazine in terms of its distribution and its circulation, but it's not in the sense that it doesn't follow the rules that most fashion magazines have, nor the seasonality, nor the actuality, let's say.
So once the designers come on board, how involved are you guys in the whole process and in managing the content and things like that? How does it actually work?
We really speak with them and their team pretty much every day along the process. Of course, as we get into the production cycle of the publication, it's multiple times a day. I think with Simone's issue, we had the first conversation, it would have been last year at the end of May. I met with Simone in New York in the Mercer Hotel, and we just started talking. And the ideas for the magazine really come from just a conversation. We asked the designer to come up with a theme, to come up with an idea of how they want to work through the publication. It can be, like with Simone, it's about family, it's about Ireland, and it's about Hong Kong. With the previous curators of the magazine, Ecos Lada, they wanted to just look at what a fashion publication means to them and to their community around them. And following that first conversation, we then start to compile a list of people who are in and around the designers' community. So with Simone, it's artists like Louise Bourgeois. It goes to from her family, from her father, her mother, her brother, to collaborators she's worked with in the past. And then we always ask them who are the people that they really want to work with, who haven't had a chance to work with. And we just try and find a way to incorporate them into their world.
What are you looking for with a designer? Like when you're kind of brainstorming potential designers to curate the issue, what are you looking for?
It's really about the richness and the depth of their visual creative world and also what they stand for. I think there are a lot of amazing fashion designers in the world that are fantastic at making clothes that make people look great. But they don't necessarily underscore that with a really strong message. And we're really looking for the creative minds whose world goes above and beyond fashion and who have a clearly defined community of followers and friends, and the kind of designers whose work does touch people on a level that goes above the store experience, the wear experience, and is about feeling a sense of belonging and a sense that connecting with that designer makes you somehow a part of their world. And that could be in the way that those designers communicate their collections through presentations and shows. It could be through the way that they have perhaps already created beautiful imagery for their clothing, or it could be their personality as well. It could be the way that they decorate their stores. It could be the way that they collaborate with retailers on incredible extra projects. It's really just the kind of people that have that extra spark, and they kind of float to the surface relatively quickly and easily. And our game has always been to find them at different times in their careers, because there are people doing brilliant things in different countries all over the world in the four fashion capitals and far beyond. And what we're looking to do with the magazine is as well present these universes as little capsules. Each magazine is its own entity. And with that, we like to keep diversity through the years and through the frequency so that, you know, we're looking at menswear and womenswear. We're looking at people from different backgrounds, different ages. We're looking at clothing that's much more accessible than other brands, which are high luxury. Eckhart Slaughter's is a very inclusive contemporary art-based crowd of friends across LA and New York. They do attract a sort of younger downtown crew, whereas the issue before with Alessandro Michele was Gucci's absolute sort of cornucopia of very rich Barocco references, which is, of course, a very, very different scope. So yeah, that's really important to us.
What are some of the kind of hurdles that you face with each issue? Because, for instance, is it difficult to get some designers to open up? I mean, or clashes of personalities, or, you know, because it's almost like your editorial team changes completely for every issue. So how does that kind of work?
Well, firstly, I think the designers that accept to do the project understand a little bit about it before they take it on, and they understand the history, they've seen who's come before them. A lot of the designers working today look up to some of the earlier designers that we have worked with. People like Yohji Yamamoto and Martin Margiela are kind of part of the canon of avant-garde designers. So the different ways of approaching the magazine can allow the designer to be more or less involved personally, not only in the development side, but also on what they show editorially. And I think that there are some interesting examples, like Haider Ackermann, who didn't put a single stitch of his own clothing in the magazine. So Haider's issue is not about fashion. There are a few photographs of his team in which they may be wearing a piece or two, but in essentially every single article was art-related, it was poetry, it was literature, it was a lot of his beautiful mood boarding, but there wasn't any fashion shoots. And then, you know, on the flip side of that, you look at Eckhart Slaughter, Mike and Zoe, who modelled in a fashion shoot, wearing the advertiser's clothing. There's this kind of flip side of ways to involve the designer. We always ask them to write a letter, a curator's letter at the beginning, that introduces the magazine from their point of view, which succeeds my letter as the editor. And that is usually their only outward-facing contribution within the magazine. Simone, however, has actually styled a photo shoot with the French photographer Sarah Moon. It's a special with in collaboration with Comme des Garçons, who is a great supporter of Simone's work, and she's sold in all of the Dover Street Market stores, which is where we've just launched the issue in London. Essentially, to see a designer doing something like styling somebody else's clothes is quite an interesting exercise. Yeah. And then, for example, I mean, Alessandro Michele was also photographed in a grid of team portraits, very small thumbnails of each of the 90-strong design team that we photographed in Rome. But we kind of had to fight to get him to have his portrait in there. So there's a certain reticence to be the center of attention by some designers, for sure. But at the same time, you know, it's a way that, in a way, we're actually piecing together their world through other people's eyes. In the end, their name is on the cover and they are the center of attention. So whether their own presence has to be felt, that much remains to be said.
Dan Thorley and Blake Abbey from A Magazine Curated By, they're talking to Monocle's Jamie Waters. Finally on the programme, a new biannual title on wildlife, travel and lifestyle, the beautiful fauna, which is out on newsstands this month. Created by London-based visual effects duo Anna Gomez and Annie Satam, the magazine is a beautiful guide to the world's wild places, with original writing from celebrated authors and journalists and impeccable wildlife photography. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Anna about the new title.
We wanted to get away from just doing the usual very conservation-focused wildlife and present the readers with the way that we see wildlife, actually.
And you found this title. Is it true that you were inspired with your co-editor, Annie, in a trip to India?
Yes, that's true.
Whereabouts?
That was in Ranthambore National Park, which is in the state of Rajasthan in India. And that was the first time, actually, that we got into wildlife. It was about 4 years ago, which is quite late, I suppose, but that was when we really got really passionate about it when we saw our first wild tiger. We felt that something had changed, but it wasn't until probably a few months later, after you've processed everything, that you've realized how much it had changed you, really.
I mean, they're fascinating animals. And I know it's not the same, but there's one of my favorite stories of the first issue is called Bagheera, which is about the leopards of Javai. I mean, it's a fantastic photo story. I mean, and quite unusual because, you know, you have pictures of the leopards, but in a kind of a shadow way. It's not kind of so straightforward in a way. Who did the story and how did you commission this?
So all the photography is done by us. So mostly Annie. The writing is all done by different writers, but yes, the wildlife pieces, I think we always plan to shoot them because that's our favorite thing to do.
And it looks great.
We really enjoy doing it in minimal style, which is quite different from, I think, you're used to seeing of wildlife.
And another thing, I would like to know more a bit about your previous career. Is it true that you and Annie, did you work with visual effects?
Yes, that's true.
Tell us a bit more about that.
So actually, we're still working in visual effects at the moment. I've been working on it for about 9 years. And yeah, I've come to the UK to study when I was around 18. And I started working in visual effects around 4 years after that. And I still work in movies.
Amazing. Well, but now Faun, of course, I'm sure you're going to be very busy with Faun. How will it work? Is it going to be, is it a biannual? Do you guys have some sort of a business plan? How do you see the future of Faun going?
Yeah, it is a biannual magazine. And we do have a business plan. And we plan to carry on doing it because it's really our passion. Let's say that the magazine is just the start of what we plan to do. It's just a way to get out there. And we want to do other things eventually in the future. And we hope the magazine will lead to that.
Well, I'm already curious, you know, to see issue two as well. And another thing I forgot to say, you also got amazing, you know, writers in the magazine. You got Pico Ye, right?
Yes.
He's a very renowned writer for National Geographic. So you wanted actually to give this kind of very strong base to the magazine as well, right?
There was always a plan from the start. We always really wanted to have really good writing. It was quite difficult because it's our first magazine and financially, it is difficult, but for us, it was really important to have very strong writers. We just contacted people and we're really amazed by the support that we got from everyone.
Well, and it's only issue one, but the magazine feels already quite established when you read it,
you know.
Because of the quality of photography, the type of stories that you do. You also have, you know, as I said, it's not only wildlife, there's also fashion.
Yes.
And you wanted also to give this other space for other things as well in the title.
Yes,
right?
We did. Yeah, because we feel that sometimes you don't want to just focus so much on one thing and feel quite monotonous. And I think really Faun is represents who we are, the things that we like, and we really like design and wildlife. Fashion is something we like as well, and I think with fashion it really allows us to be a bit creative as well, because it's quite open. You can come up with concepts and do something different, and I hope people will feel that it all goes well together.
Ana Gomez there of Fauna magazine in conversation with our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Fernando. He's busy, isn't he? And our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome. Fill up Fernando's inbox yet more by dropping him a note. You'll find him at fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next week. Now, that's all we have time for. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening to The Stack. Don't forget, we like to end on a tune. And as we were talking about the delights of fauna around the globe, it could only be Wild World by Maxi Priest. Thanks for listening. It's hard to get by just upon a smile, dude.